Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Audrey Bianco, registration number 37930, and I'm here today representing Mr. Casillas. Now, the essence of this case is that Mr. Casillas was a very young man completing a deferred judgment, or a deferred juvenile adjudication, when his DNA was taken contrary to the statute on point without a warrant and without probable cause. So the question is, ultimately, can the state use the fruits of a search that is conducted without a warrant, without probable cause, without legislative or regulatory authorization, and in fact, in direct contravention of the statute on point, or whether such fruits must be suppressed in order to comply with the Constitution. So as this court knows, there's only one really issue in this case, although I've divided it into three subparts. And the first part is whether Mr. Casillas's, the taking of his DNA was a violation of the statute. Given the Attorney General's concession on that point, it's my intent to focus on the latter two points, but I'm happy to answer any questions that this court might have about the first portion of the statutory interpretation.
Ms. Bianco, I have a question.
Sure.
Trying to figure out, based on the plain language of the statute, what precisely is the alleged violation. So I read the statute, it says each of the following adjudicated offenders shall submit to and pay for the collection. Are you inferring from that a prohibition on doing it in any other circumstance?
Right. Well, and that's one of the arguments that the Attorney General made as well. I think that what I would say is this, you sort of have to look at the special needs exception under the Constitution. And in all of the cases that I looked at where the special needs exception applied, the legislature or the regulatory body had crafted a scheme permitting searches without a warrant in very specific circumstances. In this case, the only potential authorization was the statute, and this statute expressly excluded the taking of Mr. Casillas' DNA. So it's not exactly a violation of the statute, you're correct, Your Honor, but it is, the statute does not authorize the taking, and it's not authorized anywhere else under the law.
Okay, so if we agree with you that it's not authorized by the statute, you also agree that doesn't mean it's a violation of the statute?
I mean, I would argue that the statute expressly excludes taking of DNA from an adjudicated offender. So while it doesn't create a remedy for that.
When you say it excludes it, you say it prohibits that?
Well, it says specifically, these are the people who you may take DNA from, and then it carves out.
I think it says, these are the people you shall take DNA from.
Does
it say anything about may or may not?
You're right, it doesn't. It says shall, it is mandatory. And I think, you know, the essence is, the legislature looked at this area and in the context of the juvenile code, concerned about, you know, balancing of the needs of the juvenile, the best interests of the child, and the needs of society, and they said, these are the people that we want to include in a DNA database.
Have you looked at any legislative history that might inform us as to why call it an exception or prohibition exists?
I did, Your Honor. And basically, the legislative history was to the effect that, you know, they didn't talk a lot about this issue, but several members of the various committees raised this question. They said, basically, we want to know, when is somebody's DNA going to be included? And they were specifically answered by the sponsors of the bill, who said, you know, this will only be taken after a conviction. And so that doesn't exactly address the point of whether or not, you know, what is the definition of a conviction, but if you look at the larger statute and the statutory language, which specifically says that adjudication is a deferred adjudication is not a conviction, it's clear that they were allaying the concerns of those asking the questions by telling them this will not apply to juveniles who have not been convicted. So, I mean, it didn't. The legislative history didn't go into much more detail than that.
Thank you,
Ms. Bianco. Sorry to interrupt.
Absolutely.
I wanted to clarify, just to make sure I understand what your position is. Let's assume the statute does not authorize this. Your position is there's the holding of the evidence is not problematic here.
Well, my position is that, so the court.
So that doesn't violate the defendant's rights, the holding.
Well, I guess, and perhaps I inartfully said that in my brief, that what I was trying to get at is that the district court sort of said, well, it wasn't the taking that was the violation, it was the filing of the incodis. And the fact is, it was the taking and later use of the DNA that was the violation. And the DNA would not have been available for use without inclusion in CODIS. So ultimately, I guess, I don't think that the violation can be limited to the inclusion in CODIS, but that was a part of the violation. Each step along the way, his rights were violated. If the court doesn't have further questions about the statute, I'll move on to the question of constitutionality, which is what I was starting to touch on in answer to Judge Navarro's question, which is basically, if you look at the case law on this question of special means, which, you know, warrantless search is per se unreasonable unless there is an exception that applies, and the burden always rests with the prosecution to demonstrate that an exception applies to the warrant requirement. So one of the exceptions is the special needs requirement, and that was the exception that the prosecution was relying on in this case. They offered no evidence whatsoever that this was taken for a special need, that was the intent of why the DNA was taken. The statutory language, like I said, accepts this, or does not include this, does not authorize this, and you look at the larger case law, and just every case specifically points out that there is a regulatory or a legislative scheme that can circumscribe the authority of the police or the member of law enforcement who is conducting the search. And the reason for that is because they don't want to give the authorities the discretion to basically unbounded discretion. And in this case, that's exactly what happened, is we have a probation officer who chose, for whatever reason, there's no record, to take Mr. Casillas' DNA. And that is the unfettered discretion that the case law prohibits.
Well, let me follow up on that then. The fact that Mr. Casillas was on probation, okay, does that mean he had a diminished expectation of privacy? Because, and let me follow up a little bit with that, because if he were on probation for what would have been, if an adult considered a felony that would satisfy the statute, the probation is the same under a deferred as under a normal probationary sentence. There's no difference between those two. Is that correct? Is that where I'm going?
I believe I see where you're going. And I respectfully, Your Honor, I guess I disagree that the supervision is the same. Yes, they're both performed by a probation officer. But even within the case law on the juvenile adjudication statute, they refer to it as being a probation-like level of supervision. And the distinction is important because at the end of the day, the juvenile code is designed to say, if you successfully complete this, it is as though you never pled guilty, you were never convicted, this is gone.
And that goes to the deferred, not to the probation. In other words, are the terms and conditions of probation the same or virtually the same, were this a felony probation or a deferred?
Well, the prosecution didn't introduce the conditions of probation in this case, so we don't know what they were.
Does the statute help us?
Well, the statute doesn't specify, at least that I'm aware of, and I'd be happy to research this and submit supplemental briefing if you would like, but the statute doesn't specify, to my knowledge, what exactly the terms of the deferred judgment are in terms of the supervision. So I don't know that the statute helps us there particularly much without the submission of some sort of evidence.
So what, Ms. Bianco's following up, what would be the difference relative to the expectation of privacy between what you would think is regular probation versus what's going on here?
Well, one element, I believe, Your Honor, is that Mr. Casillas was a juvenile, and I think a juvenile does have a higher expectation of privacy. I think that the state has recognized, the General Assembly has recognized that a juvenile, the stigma that can come from a criminal conviction is much greater. It's not much greater, but they basically want to protect a juvenile from that potential stigma if possible. So I think that would be an important distinction. And that's
what would that distinction have to do with privacy?
Well, because ultimately, if you don't protect a juvenile's privacy, then that person isn't protected from the stigma that comes with criminal conviction. I mean, if we, that's exactly what happened in this case, his DNA was put into a national database. So, you know, that certainly would suggest that he was stigmatized as being a criminal offender. While that was in direct contradiction to the intent of the Children's Code, I would contend.
Okay, thank you.
The other significant argument the Attorney General and I have is regarding the remedy, and I'm happy to discuss this in a greater length with you if you have any questions. But in essence, obviously it's our contention that regardless of whether this is just merely an accession of the statutory language or a constitutional violation, that the proper remedy in this case is suppression that's necessary to deter the repeated misconduct that occurred in this case.
Isn't suppression appropriate for statutory violation only if it's willful and flagrant and repeated?
Yes, Your Honor. And,
that would be factual determination for the lower court, would it not?
It would.
And that was decided against you.
It was.
Thank you.
But the evidence in this case, there was no evidence that this was not recurrent, and it was not willful. The evidence overwhelmingly supports the conclusion that it was overwhelming and recurrent.
Well, you're focusing on recurrent, but what about the willful?
Well, I think the willful, honestly, Your Honor, is even more plain than the recurrent. We have the probation officer who took the DNA. We don't know exactly what was going on there. But once we have it in the system, we have a CODIS administrator who sees that this should not be in the system, reaches out to the Supreme Court administrator's office and is told in fact this should not be in the system, yet passes the DNA along to the police officer. The Supreme Court administrator's office, again, has been alerted to the fact that there is DNA in the system that should not be there, and nonetheless doesn't do anything to take it out or say you can't use this. And then we have a police officer who was informed this DNA should not be in the system, and he then took it and used it to form a lineup and to prosecute Mr. Casillas. To me, that much of the record is very clear, and there's nothing to support a contrary conclusion. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Williams, attorney registration number 43172. I wanted to start today. The people agree that this defendant's DNA was not taken pursuant to the statute authorizing the collection of DNA from juveniles. As Judge Navarro pointed out, we didn't say that necessarily meant that it was in violation of the statute because the statute didn't expressly exclude the taking of the DNA from the defendant in this case, and it doesn't say that there couldn't be another way under which taking the DNA would be authorized. If the court has no further questions for me about the statutory right, I wanted to move on to the substance of my argument.
I just wanted to clarify what you just said. So the people's position is that regardless of whether this was authorized by the statute, it was not a statutory violation?
Our position is that it wasn't authorized by this statute,
right.
By just the plain reading of the statute, but it wasn't also expressly in violation of the statute. The statute didn't specifically say, we don't take, it excluded the defendant, but it did say under no other circumstances can the defendant be required to submit his DNA.
So you do not believe there was a statutory violation?
Not necessarily. It was taken contrary to the statute, or it wasn't taken pursuant to the statute, but we're not following conceding that it was a statutory violation and that there could be no other statute, that there isn't in this case, but it didn't expressly.
Let me ask you this, do you see an implicit prohibition in the statute which prohibits taking the DNA under these circumstances?
No, I didn't read an explicit prohibition.
Okay, thanks.
I have two points that I really want to make to the court today. First, that the taking of the defendant's DNA in this instance was not a constitutional violation. And second, even if this court does find a constitutional violation, suppression wasn't the appropriate remedy. The Fourth Amendment prohibits only unreasonable searches and seizures. In this instance, the search was reasonable. A recent U.S. Supreme Court case, Maryland versus King, informs that analysis. In Maryland, the defendant contested a statute that required he provide DNA as part of a routine booking procedure for anybody arrested on a serious offense.
Let me stop you there. Isn't that a critical distinction between King and this case? Because the DNA in King was collected expressly pursuant to a statutory authorization, whereas here, at best, there is no statutory authorization, and from your perspective, at worst, there's an implied statutory prohibition.
Absolutely. I would say that the court in Maryland or King actually went further than the statute did, and they made more of a constitutional analysis. And I believe that it's a completely separate analysis, whether something is taken pursuant to statute or has statutory authorization, or whether it's unconstitutional. If you have an unconstitutional statute, or sorry, an unconstitutional search, then a statute isn't going to make that search constitutional. So the real inquiry for this court that I wanted to focus on is whether or not this search was unconstitutional. And whether or not it was reasonable really is the touchstone of my argument. In Maryland, it was taken pursuant to a statute, but the Supreme Court determined that the Fourth Amendment does not prohibit the collection and analysis of DNA from persons arrested but not yet convicted on serious charges. I feel like this is significant in this case because our defendant was not just arrested, but also pled guilty to possession of a controlled substance and child abuse in exchange for a deferred judgment. In Maryland, the court employed a general balancing test that is a lot like the special needs exception that I articulated in my brief in determining whether the taking of the DNA was reasonable. They weighed first the minimally invasive nature of a buccal swab. It's nothing like a blood draw. There's no risk of trauma, pain, or anything like that. And the court likened the swab to a photograph or a fingerprint. Second, they measured the defendant's reduced expectation of privacy. As a probationer, our defendant has a reduced expectation of privacy in Maryland. The defendant was just an arrestee. He was suspected of committing a crime and retained the presumption of innocence.
Ms. Williams, what do you say in response to Ms. Bianco's point that he was not really a probationer? He was a juvenile under supervision during the term of his deferred judgment.
It was found by the court that he was on probation. I don't have, as the prosecution didn't maybe present the records before, but I don't have the exact records of the nature of his probation or what the terms and conditions of his probations were. But I know it was found by the court that he was on probation. As Ms. Bianco said, he was on probation-like supervision. I think the fact that it's a juvenile probation, the idea of probation is supervision and monitoring and a reduced expectation of privacy. Probationers' homes can be searched. They just generally, I guess my argument is that the defendant, regardless of the terms of his probation, or if it was probation-like or exact probation supervision, definitely had a reduced expectation of privacy, very different from the average citizen.
Ms. Williams, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to follow up on that similar question to what I asked Ms. Bianco. Is there a statutory difference between probation under a deferred and normal probation?
Not that I know of. I'm not aware of any statutory difference. The information in this case is basically just that he was on probation. That was the finding of the trial court. So I'm not aware of any distinction between this defendant's special probation or probation-like terms or anything like that. I hope that answers your question. So the second factor was the defendant's reduced expectation of privacy, which is regardless of whether it was probation or probation-like terms, obviously he was subject to a lot of supervision during the term of his probation or deferred sentence. And finally, the court in Maryland looked really closely at the state's interest in obtaining DNA for identification of an inmate for, in our case, a probationer.
Well, identification isn't an issue in this case.
As much as, we can say that I think identification is the whole purpose of collecting DNA. And I think Maryland did a really good job of describing how just because we know the defendant's name in this case, that doesn't mean that identification isn't an issue. I think that identification is an issue for anybody involved in the criminal justice system.
How can it be an issue after the person has either been convicted or pled guilty, been sentenced, and is now serving that sentence, albeit under a deferred? How can identification still be an issue?
I would argue that identification is a lot more than the person's name and appearance or anything that you would know from a driver's license. I think that the state has a great need, as articulated in Maryland, for identifying not just the sort of surface level things, but identification and a really precise DNA-based system of identification provides you with a lot of history and background, just like a fingerprinting would when you run a defendant's fingerprints. It's really important, I think, for anybody that you have as part of the criminal justice system, but especially somebody who's released on probation and under supervision, for you to have a full picture of the person's past. I mean, you know, you can have people change their names or operate under aliases, and the DNA is really the thing, a lot like fingerprints, that someone can't escape, you know, and change. So I think identification is the main purpose that anybody, you know, gives their DNA, which is found in Maryland, and also it's the only purpose for which DNA can be used. I mean, when you think about it, anything that we use like the DNA for in the CODIS database is to identify people and to tie them together to their past and, you know, make sure that you have a full picture of the individual who you're dealing with. And, you know, Maryland did a much better, more articulate job than I can of describing the necessity for that sort of identification that our Supreme Court found. I hope that answered that question. We urge this court to conduct the Maryland analysis, basically. It's a special needs analysis. It's just the measure of the minimally invasive nature of the search here, which is, as the court found, basically like fingerprinting. The defendant's reduced expectation of privacy and then the state's interest. And it determined that this probationer, or this defendant, didn't have, or his constitutional rights weren't violated because the search was reasonable in this instance and of anybody similarly situated.
With respect to the special needs component of your balancing equation, what significance should we attach to the fact that the legislature could have required the taking of DNA from people in Mr. Casillas' position, but expressly chose not to? And I'm not going to address whether that's an implied prohibition, but isn't the legislature in that setting the best spokesperson for the existence of special needs? And the legislature apparently has concluded that there are no special needs for people in Mr. Casillas' position.
I definitely see your argument. I think that obviously had the legislature included this defendant, that would have been helpful to this analysis, but I don't think that it has much influence on whether or not this search was reasonable. I don't have a lot to rely on just for the fact that the state has an interest outside of our abundant case law in our U.S. Supreme Court Maryland case, and case law just in this jurisdiction that discusses the state's interest in maintaining, you know, a DNA database and in positively and conclusively identifying, thoroughly identifying people that are involved in the criminal justice system. I think that's where I get most of my state's interest argument from, actually, is just case law, because we don't have the statute present here in this instance, but I don't think that excludes anything. Like I said, the constitutional analysis and the statutory analysis are separate here. If it's a constitutional search, then they could make this, or if it's unconstitutional search, then there couldn't be a statute, you know, that authorized it.
Suppose the statute said, for some of the policy reasons that have been discussed, we don't have a strong interest in collecting DNA from juveniles undeferred.
I think that would make it for a stronger argument that the station's wish was at least reduced here. But as it stands, you know, I mean, we don't have that, and I think it would definitely strengthen the argument that we have a great state's interest in this particular class of offenders, you know, DNA and identification. But I don't think the fact that there's an absence of a statute reduces the state's interest. Okay. If there are no further questions with my first point, I just wanted to briefly address that the people don't believe that suppression is the proper remedy in this case. The defendant's request for relief for suppression here is an extraordinary request, especially where he has the opportunity to obtain relief in other ways. In this case, there was no search. He could have raised this in his original deferred judgment case at the time of the DNA swab, or he could have petitioned for removal of his DNA from the CODIS database, and there are definitely procedures in place for the defendant to seek that sort of relief. Essentially, the defendant is requesting, in this instance, is just to suppress his own identity. You know, of course, if an individual is unconstitutionally arrested and then he's thrown in prison, but his cellmate identifies him as the perpetrator of an assault the night before, we don't suppress the defendant's identity there. Or if he's unconstitutionally arrested and his mugshot's taken, that mugshot's later used to identify the defendant without an independent source, we would suppress that identification there. The defendant's DNA in this case, as the Supreme Court stated, is little more than a mugshot, a fingerprint, or any other identifying feature. Here, the defendant's remedy is expungement of his DNA from the CODIS database and not suppression. If this court has no further questions, We would urge the court to employ the reasoning by our Supreme Court of Maryland and affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you.
Your Honors, I would start by echoing, actually, the Attorney General's last statement. I would urge you to look very closely at Maryland versus King because I believe it supports my argument and not that of the Attorney General. If you look closely at the language in that decision, the court focused very carefully on the fact that the Maryland DNA Act had very specific restrictions on how DNA could be used or stored in that situation. So, for starters, they said it was taken from everyone without discretion. Second, it could not be included in the CODIS database until the defendant had been arraigned, meaning there had been a finding of probable cause, or until the defendant himself consented to inclusion in CODIS. And then third, that statute specified that if a defendant was released without a finding of guilt or without probable cause, the DNA would be destroyed. And again, the importance there is that that circumscribes discretion. And a number of the cases cited even by the Attorney General specifically address that point. In Derridine versus University of Colorado, the court specifically noted that the policy there was invalid because it had a lack of objective, non-discretionary criteria. People v. McCullough also says that one of the keys to constitutionality is that a policy does not permit arbitrary, capricious, or harassing searches, even in the case of a probationer. Roe v. Marcotte, similar. They say that lack of discretion in decisions is key to determining whether something is constitutional. Regarding the Attorney General's point that Mr. Casillas had options for other avenues of relief, the Fourth Amendment was violated at the time that his DNA was used to prosecute him in the present action. The case law all the way up to the United States Supreme Court is very clear that until the fruits of the illegal search are used against you, there has not been a violation that you have standing to protest. Ultimately, Mr. Casillas' DNA was taken out of the CODIS database, but only after this prosecution. So the fact of the matter is, this is the only proper remedy, and it's furthermore very proper because it's necessary to defer all of these various state actors who ignored the law, who ignored the Constitution, and who used the DNA anyway. I'd be happy to answer any other questions. Otherwise, we would just ask you that you reverse Mr. Casillas' conviction and vacate it for lack of evidence. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.